This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at the Zen Center of New York City. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of Zen Mountain Monastery and ZCNYC. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about the temple's retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org/ZCNYC. Thanks for listening.
This is from the Book of Serenity, case 79. Changsha's Advancing a Step, Part 2. The Pointer. The Bodhisattva appearing as a maiden on the banks of golden sand was a special spirit. Stuffing pastries into a crystal jar, who would dare to roll it? Without going into the frightening waves, it's hard to find a suitable fish. How about one expression of walking relaxed with big strides? The main case. Changsha had a student ask Master Hui, how was it before you saw Nanquan? Hui remained silent. The student said, how about after seeing him? Hui said, there couldn't be anything else. The student returned and related this to Changsha. And Changsha said, the person sitting atop the 100-foot pole, though they've gained entry, this is not yet the real. Atop the 100-foot pole, they should step forward. The universe in all directions is the whole body. The student said, atop the 100-foot pole, how can you step forward? And Changsha said, the mountains of Lang, the rivers of Li. The student said, I don't understand. And Changsha said, the whole land is under the imperial sway. Verse. The jade person's dream is shattered. One call from the rooster. Looking around on life, all colors are equal. Wind and thunder, with news of events, roust out the hibernating insects. Peach trees, wordless, naturally make a path. When the time and season comes, laboring at the plow, who fears the spring rose knee-deep mud? So, good morning, first of all. Yesterday in the Zazen Kai, I started this talk and talked about getting to the top of the 100-foot pole. And what does that mean? And so really talked about Zazen meditation and the aspect of calming the mind, developing samadhi, shamatha in the Theravada tradition, which is an essential aspect of Buddha Dharma, of Buddha's teachings and practice, along with compassion, morality, and prajna, gaining understanding. And so today I want to talk about, take up really the koan itself, which is how do you step forward from the top of this 100-foot pole? This koan appears in many, many different forms, or the point of this koan appears in many, many different forms, not just in the koans of the Zen tradition, but really in Buddhist teachings, particularly in the Mahayana, in which the non-duality of sacred and mundane, of the world and the absolute, is realized and practiced and manifested. And this koan is really talking about that very, that great matter. Changsha was a contemporary of Zhaozhou, the great master Zhaozhou, or Zhaozhou in Japanese, who used the koan mu. And they were both students of Nanquan. So here Changsha is sending a student to Master Hui, another master, who I couldn't find any information about, but was also clearly a student of Master Nanquan. Because he asked him, how was it before you saw Nanquan? And so reaching the top of the pole is reaching the top of the mountain. And so Dogen, in the Zen tradition, we speak of ascending the mountain training, in which we start on the street, We start in the world, and we begin to ascend the mountain, which is a way of talking about training. And that all that I talked about yesterday in terms of how we're developing our Zazen and working with the restlessness of the mind and all of our attachments and our fixed views and the kleshas, afflictions, emotional states, and so on, all that we encounter in the course of our own practice and in our lives, the Buddhism understands so deeply because it's we must understand this if we want to ascend the mountain, if we want to go into the heart of being. Because it's all of that that appears to obstruct us from that journey. It's all of that which gives rise to suffering that seems to obstruct us in the path. Reaching the top of the mountain or the top of the pole, to sit on top of the pole, is an image or metaphorical way of talking about experiencing the absolute, the absolute dropping off of body and mind, realizing that the self is empty, that the nature of all things is empty. Empty of permanence, empty of any inherent quality or value, empty of self. So a body is empty of body. So we can talk about this human form as my body, right? That word describes or encapsulates all of this and creates the sense of some essential, unified, cohesive, self-existing thing. But if you examine this that we call the body, where is the body in this? Right? This is just an aggregate of different parts: fingers, hand, arms, legs, head, torso. And each of those parts has its own name. But if you look at where is the finger in this, you don't find anything that is a finger. You just find parts, more aggregates. And all of the, and go so on as you go further and further in. And all of those aggregates are existing in this moment because of karmic causes and consequences and because of certain conditions being present. So there are certain conditions that have to be present in order for this to exist in this form. We call that life. And when those conditions are no longer present, the condition of this changes, goes through a transformation, a more substantive transformation. We call that death. And so because it doesn't self-exist, it only exists as a result of those causes and conditions, because there is nothing, there's no body in the body, in the same way that there is no anger. When you look in anger, you can't find anything that is anger. Nothing is self-existing. And so being empty is to be empty of autonomy, of self-existence, of an independent reality that is separate and distinct from everything else. And this is of revolutionary consequence. Right? This is why the Buddha talked about training as a revolution of mind. It's not just shifting from attachment to non-attachment, it's a whole revolution of how we understand things. And so Dogen spoke of it as to study the way is to study the self, to study all of those aggregates, all of those things that arise, that we take as afflictions and suffering. And in studying the self, we forget the self. We realize, we let go of our grasping to that sense of I am, and realize the self is empty. And we realize that that self-nature is the self-nature of everything. Every thought, every emotion, every sensation, every object, every mountain, every pole, every time. And as Dogen said, to forget the self is to drop off the body and mind of self and others, to realize the emptiness of self and other. Sitting atop the 100-foot pole. And that is an image that's used because when you're on top of the mountain, the street where you started seems very far away. You can't see it. You can't hear the cries. You can't see the dust. You can't see the activity. And that's a metaphor for the experience of emptiness, where there is no self. There is no awareness. There is no time or place, where all of that has dropped off, which is really more accurately said by it is not being created. No one creates a state of emptiness. It's not possible. Emptiness by its very nature is uncreated. That's why the Buddha talked about nirvana as being unbound. In a sense, all of our suffering arises from binding, putting things together, composing, constructing. So in a sense, we're all like general contractors, right, for the self, and working way, way over time. And so here, Changsha says, so when the student asked Master Wei, how was it before you saw Nanquan? He's saying, seeing Nanquan is another way of saying meeting the mind of. How was it before you saw Buddha? Before you realized your self-nature? How was it before? Hui remains silent. But don't say that he's not expressing. He's expressing how it was before he saw Buddha. And then the student says, how about after seeing Nanquan, after seeing Buddha? Hui says, there couldn't be anything else. Practice in enlightenment doesn't change us. That isn't necessary, right? Because we already have Buddha nature. We're already full, our being, as is the nature of all things, is already fully in accord with all things. But because of our consciousness, because of what we do to things in our mind, we create a lot of complications. But fundamentally, there couldn't be anything else. So when Changsha heard this, he said, the person sitting atop the 100-foot pole, though they have gained entry, though Master Wei has gained entry into this dropping off of body and mind, he hasn't yet gained the real. He should step forward. The universe in all directions is the whole body. And there's much in training and much in the literature and much in the koans about this very moment. You know, it's where, you know, in the same ways that when we first come into practice, we want to hold on and preserve our identity, our body and mind, our suffering, at the same time that we want to be free of it. We're actively holding on to it, our attachments. And then with practice, as things become more calm, the body is less restless, it is more naturally at rest within itself. The mind begins to calm and find its natural tranquility. And the world begins to transform in our experience and our perceptions because of that. We realize how much of our internal state is mirrored as we look out into the world. And so then we want to preserve that. We want to preserve that state of concentration or calm or samadhi. And then when we keep going and we realize the fundamental emptiness of self and other, we want to preserve that. We want to hold on to that. It becomes something precious, like putting pastries into a jar. Don't roll it. It's going to mess them up. Right? An old master said, I always tell people that it's much like someone having taken their grandparents' house and business and all of their relatives themselves and selling them off on the same ticket and then putting all of that into a crystal jar which you keep with you wherever you are, guarding it like your eyeballs, preserving it. It's precious. He says, don't let me see this. He says, I'll surely pick it up and smash it, making your hands free so you can be joyfully alive without any taboos. without any places or things that are off limits. And so this is, you know, and this is poetry and it's metaphorical, but it's talking about a very real part of the spiritual journey that happens in a sense all along the way, as I just spoke about. I mean, we try and preserve all kinds of things. You know, as we're letting go of attachments, we just let go and then turn that to something else, something new. And so the persistence with which we have to practice, the constancy of the need to continue to practice letting go, and to discover what that actually is, because we're afraid that if we let go, you know, we'll lose it. But we're regarding it as something that is, as something that is an object, this state of mind, right, that I've worked so hard to cultivate, this state of calm. I want to hold on to it. I don't want to lose it, right? And in that, I'm turning it into something permanent, like an object, like a treasure. I'm already losing it. I've already lost it. In that very attachment, I am already suffering because I'm afraid I'm going to lose it. And then as I watch it slip away, now I'm frustrated, I'm disappointed, and the cycle continues. And so, unfortunately, most of us have to go through that over and over and over and over again until we see. And we stop trying to reconstruct, to preserve. The footnote says to this line, says, at the extreme, it's very much like cutting off and discarding. That sitting atop the 100-foot pole, we take as liberation. But that's why we chanted this morning in the identity of relative and absolute. To realize the absolute is not yet enlightenment. Getting to the 100-foot pole is a very important part of the practice, but it's not yet liberation. Why? Because we haven't yet entered the real. And so there is descending the mountain training. Because what happens when you're on a journey and you reach the top? Well, if you live there, you die there. And so the only way to continue is you keep walking. Well, what happens when you keep walking on the top of a mountain? You go down. And so there is ascending and descending the mountain training. And it happens simultaneously. That in actual training and life, if we're practicing, that we're constantly turning in and turning out. We're turning into that silence, that stillness, realizing that emptiness, and at the same time, we're stepping forward because we're living our lives. And training is intended to manifest what this old master said, don't let me see you hanging on to that top of that pole. I'll surely pick it up, that which is you're preserving, and break it so that your hands are free. And now you can be joyfully alive. And really, this is the question of how do we live awake? How do we live in harmony with self and other? Because there is no other harmony. There's no such thing as being in harmony with ourselves and in disharmony with everything else. That's not yet being in accord. You know, it's like, you know, I'm playing the violin in an orchestra and I am perfectly in tune with myself, but I'm out of tune with everybody else. The only way that works is if all of you cease to exist. That's sitting atop the mountain. And that's not yet liberation. And that's why, particularly in the Mahayana, there is so much emphasis on this, because we would like to stay there. Because we don't have to deal with all this madness. And so that's the great love of the Bodhisattva, is that they joyfully head back down that mountain because they actually want to be useful. They want to be of service. They don't want to just preserve their own mountaintop. So this is the, you know, as I've often said, this is the imperative of Buddhism. You know, most traditions, I would imagine that the assumption is that that path, that teaching, those practices of that religion or spiritual path should have something to do with your life, right? Whether that's encouraged or emphasized or made explicit. But in Buddhism, that's the whole deal. That's the only show in town. So sitting atop the 100-foot pole, how do you step forward? I've been reading this article that one of the members of the Beyond Fear of Differences planning group sent around. That's pretty academic, but I want to pull some passages from it because they're talking about Buddhism mindfulness mostly, even though it's very academic. And so it's very academic, but it's speaking from a kind of Buddhist perspective. But it's good to encounter, you know, other views and other expressions that other people in other fields that are studying how things work. It's good to study those because if what they're saying is true, in other words, it actually has to do with reality, it should be consistent with Buddhist teachings. Because Buddhist teachings and practice is about reality, which means this place we're living in. And so it should be wholly consistent. It doesn't mean it's going to be exactly the same because much of what we'll be reading is often information, fact, you know, based, scientific, inquiry-based, measurable. Whereas Buddhism is leaping forward, off into the unknown. But still, there will be consistency. So in this article, it says, the contemplative logic of the first foundation of mindfulness, which is mindfulness of the body. So the four foundations of mindfulness, which is a seminal teaching about meditation, that the first foundation is mindfulness of the body, which you can think of as the breath. It says, the contemplative logic of this first foundation is paying appropriate attention to how a body is unavoidably exposed to vulnerability as it navigates the world. In other words, we are in this physical body, we have senses. And so being mindful within the breath, within this body, means we're continually coming up against our vulnerability within this very physical body, within these senses. Right? Our senses are experiencing that vulnerability as pain or pleasure, hot or cold, tight or relaxed. And so that as we turn in, rather than, you know, moving towards what we might think we want, which is invulnerability. Like, I want to become invulnerable to suffering. It's exactly the opposite. We are becoming keenly aware of our actual vulnerability as we navigate the world. This human body is so powerful, so resilient, and so fragile. The Buddha said, the end of the world can never be reached by walking. Right? You can't just keep going west. What happens is you just come back around and end up where you were. However, without having reached the world's end, there's no release from suffering. I declare that it is in this fathom-long carcass, body, with its perceptions and thoughts, that there is the world. There is the origin of the world, the cessation of the world, and the path leading to the cessation of the world, the Four Noble Truths. That it is it, the totality of the teachings, the totality of the path, is in this body, is what he's saying. I mean, think about that. Take that in. Reflect on that. Now, what is this body that contains the whole world, its origin, the cessation from all suffering, and the path? to forget the self, to free oneself of the world, to release our grasp, is to realize body and mind. It's to reach the end of the world, but not by walking. Because in walking, we're moving away. We're looking for something outside. To reach the end of emotion, the end of thought, the end of obsession. In which it doesn't mean that there are no thoughts or emotions. It means now that we're no longer bound by them. It means the end of all self-created mental fabrications. Reaching the end of all things means all things are now liberated in their own Dharma state. We call that Dharmata. The article goes on to say the body is less an entity, a thing, self-existing, autonomous, than a living set of relations. This is what the Buddha said. He said, because of causes and conditions, they're just putting it in, you know, more academic language. But the Buddha said, because of causes and conditions, in every moment, there is experience. A moment of experience. It doesn't belong to you. It's not you. It's not self-existing. It's not permanent. It's already past. It doesn't belong to you. It is only to be experienced. A living set of relations. Put this way, what that helps us to remember, be aware of, is that moment is a result of a living dynamic set of relations, both here and here. Right? Because this moment isn't separated from environment, context, history, society, culture, neighborhood, family. And so the authors say it cannot be fully dissociated from the infrastructural and environmental conditions of its living and acting. And this is really important because, you know, we can read the literature, we can even do these koans and present them and be gaining understanding and in our mind be divorcing it from real life. In the same way that we can chant the four bodhisattva vows, I want to alleviate the suffering of all beings, and not be trying to actually alleviate suffering for all beings. Right? That it's like, it's enough that I make this vow. And so what they're doing is connecting it, right, to infrastructure, to environment. Karma, this is the way karma works, right? The karma is my actions and the results of those actions, which when based in greed, anger, and delusion, create a lot of suffering. When they're based in an enlightened view, in selflessness and generosity and patience, and loving kindness, it heals the world. But the karma, the actions that I bring forth, are not isolated, disassociated from this infrastructure. This place, you, this city, this world, this nation, and all of its structures, its histories, its narratives, all of that is in a dynamic state of relatedness, a living set of relations. Thus, we are responsible for our own actions, but we're also responsible to each other. And so when a corporation, you know, which has only loyalty to make as much profit as possible and has no loyalty to the place where it resides, the town, the city where it has established itself, and employs people, but when then that's no longer profitable, it just leaves. Right? Because its only relation, it, the corporation, which is just people, that is valid or is important is its relationship to profit. And so it is by that very, those very mindset is creating suffering and is denying its actual reality, which is why it creates suffering. And so the authors go on to say, to frankly admit that choiceless exposure to vulnerability, I like that, choiceless, like you don't have a choice, right? You show up, this is the way it is. We are exposed to vulnerability of self and other, ourselves in the world, that makes one materially and relationally dependent. This allows us to take an affirmative stance regarding the precariousness of life. It affirms that living is only possible with care, trust, and safety. And this is very much a Buddhist way of seeing it, that rather than that vulnerability being a bad thing, first of all, it's just the thing, right? Whether you like it or not, it's not going away. Right? And so all of our attempts to make ourselves invulnerable, which is really what our attachments are trying to do, is really ignoring the fact of the matter, which is we are vulnerable, which is why those attachments don't ultimately work. And that we are, in fact, dependent upon each other. All things arise together. All things are codependent, form and emptiness, self and other, sickness and health, subject and object, the hater and the hated, the lover and the beloved. They coexist. They arise at the same time. They're mutually dependent. Now, from the point of view of separateness, you know, of wanting to just have my mountaintop and keep it safe, to build a wall, that really sounds like a bad deal, that we are codependent. Because that means I am in some kind of relationship to you, and I'm trying to create the opposite of that. I'm trying to convince myself that I can just do my own thing and it has no impact on you, and you can do your own thing and it doesn't get to me. But when we, and so I'm going to have to build a bigger and bigger wall, right? Which is why the one who wants to build the wall is such a perfect manifestation of delusion, right? Is a perfect manifestation of fear, and how that fear becomes broadcasted is a perfect manifestation of inner insecurity, inner delusion, inner hiding, right? An inner lack of examination, an inner lack of compassion, that then gets broadcasted out, because where else is all it going to go? What else do we have to offer except what we have going on inside of ourselves? I mean, that's our world. And so from that view, building a wall makes sense. Right? You just keep out the bad stuff. Right? And you have to keep them bad. You have to keep this bad stuff bad. Right? You can't allow it to be anything other, because then the whole thing starts coming apart. And when it starts to come apart, eventually that the trajectory of that is here. And it's like, that's off limits. Right? We're not going there. We're going out. It's not me, it's you. The enemy is always outside. That's why this is a revolution. That's why this will become more uncomfortable before it becomes joyful. Although there are moments of joy all along the way. But that discomfort is the experience of coming back to life. That discomfort is the experience of healing, of coming home again. But when we realize the real nature of things, then that codependence, that mutual arising, is like, yeah, of course. Now I have to look at all of all of the systems that I have built and that I am a part of that have been built on that old way of seeing things. And they are deep, and they are many, and all pervasive. That's why I don't want to get off the top of this pole. That's why I have to get off the top of this pole, to enter into the real. So the author goes on to say, but affirming the precariousness of life, right, which we generally think of as a negative thing, we want certainty, stability, permanence. Affirming the precariousness of life also invites a consideration of how everyone is given over without choice to a certain promise, or you might think obligation or responsibility. An open-ended, never-ending, ceaseless task of bearing truthful witness and becoming responsive to vulnerability, mine and yours, whether human or non-human, Buddhist or non-Buddhist, believer or non-believer, saint or demon, asshole or good guy. That's the Bodhisattva vow. Is once we begin to see the way things are, it creates they're kind of being generous here. It's invites a consideration, like, yeah, consider this. That everyone is in the same position. Everyone is in the same place. Everyone is in a state of vulnerability. And we are in this together at the same time. And we are mutually creating, mutually arising, mutually creating suffering, mutually creating an end to suffering, an open-ended task that we have to witness and then respond and become responsive to the vulnerability regardless of the nature of the being, animate and inanimate, present and future. And yet, even though it is without choice, how many ways do we devise to, no, thank you. I appreciate the offer, but I'd rather not. I'd choose not. All the ways we try and make ourselves invulnerable. You know, I remember working, you know, particularly in the early years when I was more actively working in the prisons, and we were really kind of just getting started and learning. There's so much learning that need to happen in both ways. And the so many of the guys, we were working in men's prisons, maximum security prisons, thought, you know, letting go and opening the heart, and it's like, no thank you. No thank you. I'd like to be enlightened. Thank you very much. But vulnerability, I'm not, no thank you. Because to these guys in a prison setting, that was like, are you kidding me? That's suicide. And so, but what so many of them found by practicing and trying not to be vulnerable was the power of their practice showed them the choicelessness of their vulnerability. And very importantly, they realized it as strength. That it wasn't what they thought it was. So much of what we experience in practice is not what we think it's going to be. Thank goodness, it's so much better. I mean, that responsiveness to vulnerability, I mean, that's isn't that zazen, like in every moment? Allow yourself to be vulnerable to this thought, this emotion, this state, this discomfort. Goes on to say, the prevailing logics of domination exploit unequal existential and material exposure to vulnerability. Right? Everything is not, right? There's a table set, but not everyone's invited. Those who sit down at the table are not welcome to eat everything that's there. Our very existence, right, is in a sense not offered equally to everyone. because of the logics of domination, which targets those perceived to be a threat, those on the other side of the wall, to be fought or even to be exterminated. Domination thus means the attempt to safeguard some people from existential precariousness, while at the same time this privilege of protection is based on a differential distribution of the precarity of all those who are perceived as other and considered less worthy of protection. And so this is the harsh existence of samsara. It's the harsh existence of a domination model of a society, of a culture, which is our culture and society. The domination of men, the domination of white, being white, the domination of being heterosexual. All of these different forms of domination. You know, in a very small, I feel very small way, when I used to, living in Brooklyn full time, and I was going to a lot of, you know, clergy meetings, you know, that Eric Adams, the mayor, would call. So clergy from all around Brooklyn would come. And the atmosphere was very warm and friendly, and, you know, I enjoyed being there, but it was definitely a domination of one God. Right? There was a presumption that everybody there, and sometimes they would even say it, you know, a pastor would get up and say, isn't it wonderful that we're Buddhists and Christians and Jews and Muslims and we all believe in the same God? excuse me. And that's what happens in a domination environment, is there is that presumption, right? That my experience is your experience. It's working for me. Isn't it working for you? If it's not working for you, well, just get your shit together. The harsh existence of domination, right? And in a sense, like, take that in. Right? Do we see the patriarch here? Here being whatever body you might occupy, right? When we separate it from just male, the male form, do we see our own patriarch? Do we see our own dominator model here, right? When we try and squelch, right? Control, aggress, manage, manipulate. That's where else does the model come from? And so all of those dualities, you know, that we see within and without in our culture, you know, that we see in a state of revolution, Me Too, Black Lives Matter, that the dominator model is suffering. It can only be sustained by continually reinforcing it, continually. That's why when it is threatened, it gets stronger, right? That's why, in a sense, I feel like when Obama was elected, I knew that there was going to be a stronger retaliation, right? Because of the threat of that. But of course, that's how things change. And don't we see that within ourselves? We let go, and then we hold on more fiercely. The mind calms, and then it's followed by a state of extreme agitation. Right? We feel like everything's coming together, and then everything falls apart. Pushback. And I think as practitioners, that can give us a window. You know, when we really study, do our practice, and really watch closely and study carefully, it's really giving us a window into how the world works. And it's still painful. It's still hard to hold. You know, it's hard to accept what is unacceptable and to work from that place of acceptance to try and affect change. But it can help us to see how this body and all the functions in this body, as we're trying to liberate it, is what happens in other bodies. Governmental bodies, institutional bodies, corporate bodies, group bodies. And so the goes on to say, across such diverse contexts, making refuge investigates the contingencies of responsibility. I love that. The contingencies of responsibility. Do we understand the implications of this? No. I think it's safe to say no. We don't understand. And that's probably a good thing, I think, actually, that in the beginning, we don't actually understand the implications. You know, it's like when we fall in love. It's just good. It's just good. We don't, you know, until we get more life experience, we don't actually understand the implications of this yet. Or when you're getting ready to have a child, right? It's like, we know it's going to be difficult and challenging, but we don't really understand the implications, right? Even if we watched other people do it, because we haven't done it. And that lack of understanding is part of what gives us the courage or craziness to leap, right? And then we find out, right? Which is why we need to be as conscious as we can as we leap. And so I think that's true in practice. You know, when we come in, we're just like, I just want to, like, put an end to suffering. That's all. Right? I just want to be enlightened. I'd like to, like, be a compassionate being. So let's just do this. And we don't really understand, because if we did, we'd probably like, I'll get back to you. And so in a sense, as we develop and our capacity to see and to hold increases, we understand the further and further implications of this as we are able to. And I think that works in a way exactly as it must. As we are able to hold the contingencies of our responsibility, of our mutual obligation, of our personal obligation, we're ready for that. We won't always feel ready, but we are ready. And that we experience it less and less as binding, as a burden, as a drag, and more as joyful, as a freeing of our confinement. And so to really examine this deeply, so how can you step forward? Changsha says, the universe in all directions is the whole body. To cease dividing. Cease compartmentalizing. In stepping forward from the top of the 100-foot pole, you haven't left the mountaintop. That's why we say, speak about being on the mountain and not having left the world. Being in the world and not having left the mountain. We only divide in our mind. To not step forward and engage our lives and care about our world in a real way is really based on the illusion that we can opt out of that. All that means is that the degree to which we are responsibly or in a beneficial way engaging is being minimized. Right? Not having an impact. You know, I've told the story before about years ago when there was a student in the monastery who was, you know, practicing and developing and so was being given more responsibility. He came to me one day at his desk and he said, I would like to be given positions that don't have any impact on anyone else, please. And I said, even if I could and I can't, that's just not going to happen. It's not possible. Even without having these given responsibilities, you are having impact. How do we step forward? Really, the better question is, how do we not step forward? If we see that and we practice that, then stepping forward is in place. It's like, how do you not attach? How do you be free of attachments in the moment when you're attaching? It's not theoretical. So Master says, let go over the cliff. Let your whole body be nothing but the myriad forms. What's that like? The mountains of Lang, the rivers of Li. the mountains of Catskill, the river of Hudson. It reaches everywhere. It's broad and deep. And that nature, that self-nature, manifests in 100,000 forms. Here's a few. Everywhere we look, we see manifestations of that. Everything in the universe moves in accord with its own Dharma state and the Dharma state of all things. Because of human consciousness, we divide things. And that can have a very powerful function. But we add meaning to our divisions. We make presumptions that are not true. And we build systems and worlds based on that. To sort of manifest this in our everyday life is the greatest leap. The mountains of Lang, the rivers of Li, the footnote to that says you bump into it everywhere. Indeed. That's what happens in practice. The more and more you practice, the more you bump into yourself everywhere. And many of you have come to Dokusan and said exactly that. That more and more you see that everywhere you go, you're seeing yourself. You're seeing your mind, you're seeing your patterns, you're seeing your habits. And again, from the point of view of somebody who just wants to stay hidden, this is really bad news. But if you actually want to be free and actually want to leap forward, this is really good news, because it means now you can practice everywhere. And so he says in the poem, one call from the rooster rouses us from our dream. What is that call of the rooster? What is it that rouses you from the dream, that motivates you, that raises bodhicitta, that brings you into a state of caring and responsibility? Peach trees wordlessly make a path. When we look around, we'll see examples of stepping forward everywhere. But we have to learn to hear the language of the peach tree. We can't bring our own self, our own agenda into it. And then when the time and season comes, it's here. Laboring at the plow, who fears the spring rose knee-deep mud? In other words, don't wear white. Be prepared to tumble. Be prepared to engage. Right? It doesn't start now. It started a long time ago. The question is, do we want to be in this awake or not? We actually have that choice. And that's the door. So. Maybe that's enough.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.